Today, the Push Me, Pull You Economy, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 2nd of November 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And in today's digest of recent events, we look at the Fed's rate cut, new record highs on the US markets, and locally, more weak economic news, and various views about how strongly the housing market is recovering. As usual, we start with the international news, but if you want to go direct to the Australian segment, the time is shown below. And in the comments, we also list the main topics we cover. There was both good news and not so good news from the US this week. Better employment, weaker manufacturing, and mixed inflation, all signalling perhaps that the US economy is growing steadily. Or perhaps not. The US non-farm payrolls came out on Friday, adding 128,000 jobs to the economy, beating expectations of 89,000. October's numbers were revised higher as well, from 136,000 to 180,000, and the revision makes October's headline data even stronger. So the drag from a strike at General Motors was made up for in other areas of the labour market. The inflation component was just as strong, although the headline average hourly earnings number was a slight miss at 0.2% compared with 0.3% as expected, September's numbers were revised from 0% to 0.4%. But on the other hand, the ISM manufacturing PMI for October came in slightly worse at 48.3 versus 48.9, which was expected, and 47.8 last time. Anything below 50 means that the economy is contracting. And this is the third straight month of contraction. Even more worrisome is the ISM Manufacturing Price Index, which fell to 45.5, compared with 49.9 expected and 49.7 last time. And earlier in the week, the Fed cut rates again, as Jerome Powell explains.
I wonder if you could give us a little more texture on sort of what the strongest or most important case is for feeling that you've now taken out adequate insurance. Is it the response you're seeing in housing and other parts of the economy, arguably to the cuts made so far? Is it the fact that the risk environment out there globally has shifted a bit and abated a bit? Or is it something different, you know, in the financial markets, the fact that the yield curve has righted itself, et cetera?
Honestly, it's really the there isn't any one factor. It's really the whole range of economic data, and also what we see as about our stance of policy, which we believe is the appropriate stance. It's really both of those things. Again, if you look at the performance of the economy through this, the consumer sector has been quite resilient. Witness today's GDP report. And it's just, again, all the things I went through earlier suggest that that sector continues to be strong. We know that the manufacturing, investment, trade, export sector has been weak. That continues. But nonetheless, overall, we've got an economy that is showing moderate growth. And we think that today's setting, we're now at 1.5 to 1.75%. That is, we believe, an accommodative level and a level that will support that outlook that we have.
Really, this is kind of a one-legged recovery, that unless you get some impetus from other things, exports, investment, that it's going to weaken further at some point?
You know, we don't see any evidence of that. What we see is that the consumer sector continues strong. Again, low initial claims. It's all the data we monitor, obviously a very broad range of data. We also see now, I think, more clearly the effects of more accommodative monetary policy on various kinds of consumer activity. You're seeing strong durable goods sales. You're seeing housing now contributing to growth for the first time in a while, 0.2, I think, this quarter. And you're seeing retail sales. The retail sales number, the PCE number, as I mentioned in today's release, was 2.9%. So that's good. And I think More broadly, monetary policy is also supporting household spending and home buying by keeping the labor market strong, keeping workers' incomes rising, and keeping consumer confidence at high levels, where it currently is.
Okay, Scott Horsley at NPR.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're just talking about how the lower rates have affected consumer behavior. Is there a concern that there's just less potency on the business investment side, that you're, in effect, pushing on a string?
Well, I think monetary policy works through the channels that we understand. I think the effects are clear in what we think of as the interest rate sensitive sectors, which are the ones, some of the ones that I mentioned. I think interest rates are a factor in business investment, but I don't believe they're the main factor, a main driver. And I think what one would like to see to support greater manufacturing activity, business investment, and exports would be a global recovery. And there's a lot of monetary policy accommodation and some fiscal accommodation, maybe, in the global economy now, not here, but perhaps elsewhere. And that should support growth in the global economy. And again, resolution of our trade issues would contribute to that over time as well.
Essentially, monetary policy is, quote, in a good place, and the consumer is strong, suggesting less chance of more cuts ahead. But also, there are still some questions remaining about the non-QE, QE, aka the repos. And sentiment was supported by data showing China's manufacturing activity unexpectedly expanded in October, with the Keilin Market Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index in at 51.7 for the month of October, compared with the expectation of 51. And that eased concerns about a slowdown in demand from the world's second largest economy as a result of US tariffs. And finally, there was more encouraging news about the trade negotiations between the US and China, as Beijing's state media news agency reported the two countries have reached consensus on principles. And earlier, US Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said that the Phase 1 trade pact with China appeared in good shape. And also announced on Friday by the People's Bank of China was China's steps to stabilize the yuan exchange rate against the US dollar, which could facilitate the signing of a Phase 1 trade deal with the United States. The latest move would see a total of 30 billion yuan denominated securities sold in Hong Kong next week. This is a widely used method to push up investors' borrowing costs, making it more expensive for speculators to bet that the yuan will fall. The auction on Thursday will include 20 billion yuan of 3-month securities and 10 billion yuan of 1-year securities. And the central bank has already sold securities in Hong Kong 9 times so far this year, with strong demand from commercial banks, mutual funds, foreign central banks, and international financial organizations. The 6-month bills sold at a rate of 2.89% in September and were 3.6 times oversubscribed. But then an unnamed Chinese official told Bloomberg that while the US and China were open and willing to continue talks after an initial phase, the two sides recognized that it would not be easy to agree on a full trade deal because Beijing is reluctant to work on the deep structural reforms that the US is pushing for. So while the data on the day was mixed, according to FedWatch, there is currently only a 14% chance of a rate cut in December, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ hit new intraday highs and set closing highs as well. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed within 12 points of its closing peak of 27,359 back on July the 15th. The S&P 500 was up 0.97%, finishing us at 3,066. The NASDAQ ended up 1.1% at 8,386. The Dow surged 1.13% at 27,347. And the S&P 100 index also set a record, up 0.98% to 1,363. A bull market that traces its lineage to the depths of the financial crisis is revving up again, notching its fourth straight weekly gain and pushing its gain in 2019 above 22%. After wavering at mid-year amid a US-China trade war and recession anxieties, American stocks are back in advance mode, ending three of the past five sessions at a record. While nobody knows if it's getting late for this decade-old rally, gains like these have been common at the tail end of bull markets in the past. A study by Bank of America on equity peaks since 1937 shows that being uninvested in the last year in advance means foregoing one-fifth of the rally's overall return. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 6.96% to 1230, a new three-month low, signaling lower risks. And about 76% of the S&P 500 companies that have reported so far have beaten profit estimates, though profit growth forecasts for the next four quarters have been revised lower, even as expectations for a decline in third quarter earnings have shrunk to 0.8% from 2.2% at the start of October. The 10-year Treasury yield reached 1.714, while the three-month was at 1.526%, so no yield curve inversion at the moment. And gold futures for December delivery was up 0.12% to 1,506, while crude oil for delivery in December rose 3.67% to 56.17. The US dollar continued its post-Fed slide, with the euro US dollar, it was up 0.15% to 1.1167, while the US dollar index futures was down 0.24% at 97.12, and Bitcoin was up 1.41% to 9,298. The Shanghai Composite rose 0.12% to 2,958, while the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index gave 0.6%, and the US dollar yuan adjusted slightly. However, a Bloomberg report suggests China may well resist signing a comprehensive trade deal, in part because its leaders don't trust Trump's impulsive nature. In a recent Forbes article, China is heading for a long growth recession, not because of the trade war. They argue that practically all of China's GDP growth has resulted from the government's pumping capital into the economy. Subtract government stimulus spending, some economists argue, and China's economy may not be growing at all. Nowadays, China is still trying to build wealth, but it's doing it by pursuing investments that do not raise the country's productive capacity and growth potential, like bridges and roads to nowhere, like factories that no longer produce competitive products, like apartments where nobody lives. The bottom line, in the post-Great Recession era, China is destroying rather than creating wealth, and that's expected to take its toll on the country's economy for years to come. And finally, of course, Brexit continued, now with an election in December which may or may not resolve anything. Who can tell? Hi, it's Liz's interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Locally, ANZ's full-year result was well down, dragged lower by more customer remediation costs, compressed margins, and higher delinquencies. And we discussed this in our post, The Credit Impulse Dies Some More. We linked the weaker results with the slowing net credit growth in October, with investment lending going backwards, and overall housing lending down to 3.1%, something not seen since the 1970s. A great household deleveraging is well underway as the credit momentum slows. ANZ has taken $1.6 billion for remediation, and it's worth reflecting on two things. First, the financial sector remediation bill is now well north of $10 billion and counting. And second, while some customers may receive compensation from these remediation pools, the broader business is leaking capital from profits, which have been generated from past misconduct. But ask yourself, how will these new costs be recovered? The answer, of course, is from more fees and margin in the future, a tax offset, and minor reductions in shareholder returns. Be clear, existing customers will still end up picking up the tab one way or another. In ANZ's case, its shares fell 2.06% on Friday to 26.19. Westpac was down 1.17%, NAB down 0.7%, and CBA down 0.53%. And ANZ's chief executive, Shayne Elliott, was unable to say when the bank's remediation program would come to an end, to the frustration of analysts who thought the bank had previously given assurances the remediation will continue for some time yet, and the tally will continue to mount and mount. The building approvals for September were weaker again, down by 35% in trend terms from the March 2015 peak, and largely driven by a 54% decline in unit and apartment approvals. There were 37,994 high-rise apartments approved across the nation in the year to September 2019, well down from the peak of 78,089 in the year to October 2015. The high-rise apartment approvals crash has been driven by New South Wales down 54%, Victoria down 58%, and Queensland down 70%, which have all fallen massively from peak. And ACT's high-rise approvals have also crashed, down 35%. Detached house and townhouse approvals are also falling, albeit at a slower rate. No surprise, then, that the construction sector is under pressure. Indeed, the ABS showed that new dwelling purchased by owner-occupier subcomponent of CPI, which measures the cost of building a home excluding the land, fell for the first time ever, down 0.17% in the September quarter and down by 0.08% year on year. Auction clearances from CoreLogic were at 72.2% last week on 2,622 auctions, compared with 2,928 a year ago. Sydney and Melbourne remain the hot spots, but just how hot, given the low volumes, is a debating point, and the number of listed properties is still well down. Which takes us to the October property price movements. CoreLogic, of course, remains very bullish, with a national 1.2% rise in the month, and this was reported widely in the media as gospel. They say the recovery trend in Melbourne overtook Sydney in October, with dwellings surging 2.3% higher over the month, the largest month-on-month gain since November 2009. Melbourne housing values have recovered 6% since moving through a trough in May 2019, while Sydney values were up 5.3% since the recent May low. The smaller capitals have delivered a mixed performance. Although the general theme is one of improving conditions, the rolling three-month change in Brisbane housing values was up 1.1%, and that was the highest since December 2015. Adelaide, up 0.1%, posted the strongest rolling quarter since December 2018, while Hobart was up 1% and Canberra up 2.4%, and that recorded the largest three-month rise in values since March 2019 and May 2017. But the downward trend in Perth and Darwin home values has continued. However, both markets, they say, are showing an improvement in the trend rate of decline, and the rolling three-month trend in Perth housing values recorded the smallest decline in 14 months, down 1.7%, and Darwin dwelling values posted a rare monthly rise in October. Both cities have seen dwelling values consistently trending lower since mid-2014, with Darwin down a cumulative 31% and Perth values down 22%. And Perth is now recording the lowest median house value of any capital city at $451,800. And Darwin house values are a close second, with a median of $468,300. However, other sources are less bullish, including the REA, which shows that many locations, even across Sydney and Melbourne, prices are still falling. And as you know, I continue to say, averages mask what is happening on the ground. Whilst many are now trying to explain away the falling credit momentum while prices are shooting higher, we think the real situation is not nearly as strong, and the link between credit growth and home price growth remains. We'll be addressing this in a future post, but suffice it to say, do not be misled by the headlines and spruikers. In many locations, sale prices are still falling, and there is no sign of a recovery. And to add to the misery, gross rental yields fell in 5 of the 8 capital cities. The largest declines were confined to Darwin, where rents were 1% lower over the past 3 months, and Sydney, where rents were down 0.7%. The only capital cities where rents were up over the quarter were Brisbane, up 0.2%, and Adelaide, up 0.3%. No wonder property investors continue to walk away. And according to the ABS, rents nationally rose just 0.1% in the September quarter and grew by just 0.4% over the year. Seven Sunrise asked me to search out some value locations where property might be attractive to buy. Of the 25 locations I identified, 23 had lower prices than a year ago, and prices continue to drift lower. This led to quite an interesting exchange on live TV last Thursday, perhaps not what they were expecting.
Good morning, you're with Sunrise. Well, affordability is one of the biggest barriers for Aussies trying to get a foothold in the real estate market. In Sydney, the average house price is now nudging $1 million. It's close to $700,000 in other capital cities. But the good news is there are still plenty of brilliant buys that you can pick up and also make money on. Experts say you just need to know where to look.
So let's find out where some of those hotspots are with property expert Martin North. Morning to you. Let's start in Sydney. You've listed St Peter's, Enmore, Waterloo and Brookvale. Why?
Because they are relatively close in, a lot of interesting demand, good infrastructure, and prices are still falling in all of those locations.
Really?
In Melbourne, Martin, it's North Melbourne, Ringwood and also Croydon. What's attracted you to those areas?
So North Melbourne, close in again, good infrastructure, attracting young people. But out west, if you go out towards Dandenong out there, established locations, good property, and again, prices not going up.
OK, let's hit Brisbane. You've listed Chermside, Kawongbar and Redland Bay. What makes those areas good value?
So two to the north, one slightly out from the centre there. But the key thing, again, is good infrastructure. Only one of the three are seeing prices rising, but there are some very good houses for sale there where the prices are still falling, so get in quickly.
And for those looking to get into the market in Adelaide, we've got hotspots that you've identified, Richmond, Marion and also Theberton. Why have they made the list?
So they're mature suburbs around the centre of Adelaide, good infrastructure, again, good houses, a lot of established properties, and again, prices are not going up there yet.
OK, so that's fine unless you happen to live in those areas, I guess. Hotspots in Hobart are Glenorchy, Moona and Kingston. What sort of price averages are we seeing there?
Yeah, so there we're seeing prices still quite hot because there's a lot of demand, particularly north of Hobart. But down south, prices are up there quite a lot as well. But again, same sort of story with good infrastructure, good local community and a lot of houses. I wouldn't go for units, I'd go for houses because they're holding their value and look to me to be quite good value ahead as well.
And Martin, what about in Perth? The hotspots there you've singled out, Stirling, Bedford and East Frio. The benefits that you see to those particular suburbs?
Yeah, so again, only one of those there's any price movement up, the other two are still falling, so there's still potential value there. Good quality houses, and again, on good infrastructure, good communities, and you know, the fact is that prices in Perth have come down quite a long way, so eventually they will recover, but it will take time.
Let's go to Darwin. The hotspots are Rosebery, Virginia and Palmerston. How do they rate in terms of value, Martin?
Yeah, they're quite good value. Remember, prices in the north there have dropped up to 30%, so they're way off their highs. And the thing to do here is to look in areas where there are, again, houses, good infrastructure is useful as well. But of course, there is very little demand up there at the moment. So essentially, I don't think we're going to see massive recoveries in that area for a long time. But if you think about value, you need to be thinking longer term rather than just 1 to 2 years.
Okay.
We'll hold you to those predictions. Martin North, thank you very much for your insights this morning.
Property is not necessarily wealth creating. And Roy Morgan in the latest wealth report made the point that Australians' per capita gross wealth increased in real terms between 2007, before the GFC, and June 2019 by 20.9%, from $306,100 to $370,200. However, they said, the strong growth generally seen over this period has stagnated in the last 6 months. In fact, we have begun to see a decline, with per capita gross wealth dropping by around $5,000 or 1.4% from the first to the second quarter of 2019. Owner-occupied homes currently account for $4.94 trillion or around 50.1% of Australia's personal asset value. The growth in net wealth is possible because although debt is growing, it's growing more slowly than the growth in assets. And in real terms, from 2007 to 2019, Australians' per capita debt increased by 13.7%, while assets grew by 20.9%. The share of net wealth held by women is growing, but there is still a gender gap. In 2007, the net wealth held by women was 81.9% of that held by men. By June 2019, this had risen to 91.4%. And globally, the richest 10% of the population hold 47% of the wealth, and that figure is matched almost perfectly in Australia, with the wealthiest 10% of the population holding 47.3% of net wealth. Meanwhile, the bottom five deciles, a full 50% of our population, have just 3.6% of net wealth. And inequality has increased rather than decreased between 2007 and 2019. And former Liberal leader John Houston told Domain on Tuesday that a federal government policy on housing affordability is, quote, little more than an election sop, while piecemeal policy and the lack of forward thinking are crippling both state and federal responses to the issue. All they're doing is saying we're going to give you lower interest rates or tax cuts, but they're not solving any of these problems. You need to get everyone focused on the magnitude of the problem. One of the big weaknesses of government is there has been no outcomes. On the financial side of things, most of the schemes just add to the price. The developers benefit from the first home buyer subsidies. At the moment, they just put the price up. And we discuss the shortcomings of the Morrison First Owner Guarantee Scheme in our post, More on the First Owner Bribe. Houston also noted this week that most of the $2.9 trillion of superannuation money is invested in stock markets, primarily in the US and Australia. You are heavily exposed when these markets are as overvalued as they are. By any measure, the US stock market is way overvalued. There is going to be a correction. It's just a matter of when and how far. Super funds are taking a risk by staying in those markets. Some have rebalanced portfolios and put a bit more into cash, but you don't earn anything on cash. Fixed interest gives you a very low return. And he also highlighted the low interest rate environment globally, highlighting that around 25% of sovereign bonds have negative rates. Finally, the ASX was up slightly on Friday to 5,527, though the volatility index was down 6.56% to 1131, signalling lower levels of risk ahead. The Aussie-US dollar was higher on a weaker greenback, up 0.3% to 69.14, while the euro-Aussie dollar was down 0.13% to 1.6150. The Aussie gold cross was down 0.17% to 2,190, and the Aussie Bitcoin cross was up 1.64% to 13,448. So there are two sets of forces pushing the markets, central banks taking rates lower towards zero or worse in an attempt to persuade households in particular to borrow more and spend more, and the rising risks from a more unbalanced, debt exposed, property exposed, zombie company exposed economy. And the swings from bull to bear and back are getting more pronounced as the risks rise. Either way, the path ahead looks uncertain. Perhaps the trade war will ease and the US economy will stay from recession, allowing markets more headroom, or perhaps the downside risks will bite harder. The debt, low rate, low growth, push me, pull you, is in full force. One reason why we remain bearish on property. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.